This is Lori Grenier. You've seen me on Shark Tank. I'm always hearing from business owners who just can't get the money they need to grow. It's time for funding to catch up to the 21st century. It's time for Cabbage. Fill out the application online and you'll get a decision in minutes and could have access to a line of credit of up to $100,000. No waiting, no hassle. Cabbage is the real deal, A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau and twice a Forbes top 100 company. So go to cabbage.com. That's Cabbage with a K, K-A-B-B-A-G-E, or call 888-CABBAGE.
Coming to you direct from the heart of New York City all the way to wherever you are, you're listening to The VIP. Jaswal Report. Ladies and gentlemen, America is a land of immigrants, but within them lies a community that even today is a minority. However, this community has achieved great success and a level of influence that other communities can only dream of. I'm talking about the Jewish community of America. So, how do they do it? What makes this community so successful, so influential? What are their values, their secrets, their philosophy that make them such a wonderful example to emulate? To help figure this out, my guest has been named as one of Newsweek's top 50 rabbis in America. He was the keynote speaker at the opening of the 106th Congress in Washington, and he's been the author of many bestsellers. He's the one, the only, Rabbi Daniel Lapin. Shalom, Rabbi Daniel.
Shalom to you. Thank you very much indeed. You sounded like my mother there for a moment.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just, gosh, it can only go downhill from such a great intro.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, sir.
I've been looking forward to it for a long time.
So I think, you know, I've been discussing the topic of this show, and everyone's thought it was controversial. And really, the topic was, why are Jews so rich? And all of a sudden, you know, everyone's ears go up. Like, I'm saying something that's politically incorrect. I'm actually, it's a compliment. It's an admiration. You know, as an immigrant and part of a minority myself, I absolutely admire the way the Jews have as a community and as individuals become such an example of success in America. I mean, you know, they're at the top of everything, whether it's in professional life, in business life. And, you know, I really wanted to know, I mean, how have the Jews become so successful where other minorities still struggle?
Well, with your permission, I'm seeing two questions here, really. Mm. You know, one is, why should it be controversial to say that there, a group of people have achieved disproportionate levels of financial success? But it is controversial. Whenever I say it to Jewish audiences, their eyes cast downwards, their feet start shuffling uncomfortably under their chairs, and they're almost of the opinion that if only Rabbi Daniel Lapin wouldn't keep drawing people's attention to Jewish financial success, maybe nobody will notice. But we have to ask ourselves, what's happened to America? And you are refreshingly free of the hang-up, but most people in the United States backpedal furiously when accused of being rich.
I know, and then, you know, you use the word accuse, and that's exactly how they feel. And I'm wondering, hey, I'd love to have that problem.
Well, that's right, yes.
And none of this, none of this success has been incidental or coincidental. It's been through hard work. It's been through sacrifice.
But it's been working smart as well as hard.
Right.
You know, I once stood at the window of a penthouse office of one of the founders of Home Depot. Mm. And we were discussing ancient Jewish wisdom's approach to wealth. Obviously, he is Jewish, and he's somebody who has thrived abundantly. And he said something very similar to what you said. He said, well, it's just I've worked my rear end off, except he didn't say rear end. Mm. And I said, come with me to the window. And fortunately, just then, as we looked down on the streets, a city bus was passing with one of those sort of big numbers written on the roof. And I said, you know, there's a guy driving that bus. He's worked his rear end off all his life as well.
Right. Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, I think you would concede that he hasn't worked any less hard than you. Mm-hmm. How come you've got the success you enjoy and he is driving a bus till 6 o'clock this evening? So it's not just a case of working hard. It's more than that.
So let's get into it then. How does a Jew think?
Well, to lay the foundations of this and to paint the landscape just a little bit, let's acknowledge the extent to which American culture at this stage of the Republic's history has made the possession of money and the acquisition of wealth a badge of dishonor. Let's just think for a moment about who is the most vicious villain in almost every primetime crime drama, in almost every single movie that has a villain. It's nearly always a corporation, a business entity, or a business professional, usually a white businessman. Mm-hmm. And almost inevitably, so much so that it's almost cliched as the camera pans up the side of the gleaming glass skyscraper and zooms into the office on the top floor, you see the businessman being confronted by our brave young hero who accuses the businessman's company of polluting the environment or some other similar sin. And at that point, the businessman reaches into the top right-hand desk drawer to pull out what, as you and I know, every businessman keeps in his top right-hand desk drawer, and that is a stainless steel 357 Magnum revolver. And he's just about to do away with our hero when the United States Marines swoop in and save the day, or some other similar artifice intrudes. But this is nearly always the picture. And the list of movies, we could literally list them off, like 40, 50 movies of the last few years. And even to the point where movies are redone, they change the original story. So, for instance, the original Manchurian Candidate had the bad guys were the Chinese communists and the North Koreans. In the recent Paramount remake of the Manchurian Candidate, the bad guys is essentially the Halliburton Corporation.
Right, but I'm trying to – what is your point here?
My point is that people are being conditioned to believe that business is bad and making money is evidence of malfeasance. And to contrast that with the Jewish approach makes it clear, I think, as to why this is so unusual. So much so that many of my people, ourselves, many of us have become awkward and uncomfortable about our success. And my point is...
But that hasn't prevented them from being successful. So what I really wanted to do...
What it has done is had them engage politically in such a way so as to prevent other people from being successful.
Okay.
So in other words, instead of being out there encouraging young people to become entrepreneurs, teaching them the secrets and the skills of making money, instead what they do is work on increasing the minimum wage, as if Jewish affluence in America was based on incremental increases in the minimum wage. So in other words, what we have done for ourselves, we feel sufficiently uncomfortable about that we're not willing to do for other people.
Okay. Let me then position the question in another way. How do Jews bring up their families? I don't want to get political about this in terms of minimum wage or anything. I want to take it down to grassroots level where it's a family life. I want to get into the mindset because,
let me give you an example.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll give you an example.
Not a movie, I hope.
No, okay. No, we're going to go straight to the Bible. Is that okay?
That's great.
Okay. Famous story, Cain and Abel. Okay. And to reduce it to its essentials, chapter 4 of Genesis, for people who actually want to look at it, but I'll provide all the information. Cain brings a gift, an offering to God. First time in the Bible this has happened. I'm sorry, did I interrupt you?
Nope.
Abel copies him and says, hey, that's a good idea. Me too. I'll also bring a gift to God, which he does.
Right.
Next verse, God welcomes Abel's gift and rejects Cain's gift.
Right.
Next verse, Cain is miserable, depressed, and unhappy. And then God says to him, hey, Cain, what are you so miserable about? Now, you would have thought that the next verse after that would be Cain responding to the Lord saying, what? You're asking me what am I upset about? What do you think I'm upset about?
Mm.
I thought of this whole idea of a gift. I brought a gift, and you take my younger brothers and you reject mine. And now you still ask me what am I upset about? Obviously, I'm upset about that.
Mm.
But he never does that. I'm telling you now how this section is studied at a Jewish table. So we ask ourselves, why would that be? Why would it be that Cain does not respond in this most obvious way? For heaven's sake, what do you mean, why am I upset? Isn't it obvious? And yet he does not respond to God. He walks off, and the next thing is he does away with his brother. But
Rabbi, you know what? That's a brilliant answer to a question that's not asked. That's a brilliant answer to a question that's not asked. I
haven't given the answer yet. The answer is critical to Jewish business success.
Okay, what is the answer?
The answer is you have to look at Exodus 14, where the Israelites are standing on the shore of the Red Sea. The Red Sea is blocking their way forward, and there behind them in the horizon is a big cloud of dust. The Egyptian army is approaching to capture them and re-enslave them, drag them back to Egypt. So they're between a rock and a hard place. This is not looking good. So they start wailing and crying and weeping, and God's response, cut it out. Start walking into the ocean. Ancient Jewish wisdom teaches that, and if you look at the verses carefully, you see that the water doesn't split until they're all in it up to their necks. In other words, you've got to actually take a step in your own salvation. You can't just sit and cry. Going back to Cain, God says to Cain, hey, you know, you're not happy. It's in your hands. You can improve. It's your nature. The Jewish principle that emerges from this is that the only time you are permitted to be gloomy and despondent and miserable and grumpy and whiny is when there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. For instance, if you're mourning the death of a loved one. It's perfectly understandable that you're unhappy and miserable and depressed when that happens, because there's absolutely nothing you can do about it.
All right, Rabbi Daniel, you know what? Let me position this question in another way. I'm trying to get to the nitty-gritty here. I'm a South Asian. I've been brought up on three fundamental values. Work hard, get an education, get a job. Yet, I think a lot of South Asians, they work very, very hard. They do all of those things. But the amount of success that the Jewish community has is unprecedented.
Right.
And they have the influence. So when children are sitting at a table with their parents for dinner, and they sort of they come home from school, what are the sort of fundamental values that are being told to the children that will help them succeed? Because, you know, a lot of South Asians are employees. A lot of Jews are employers.
Correct. Correct.
So what would be the top three things?
Again, the lesson from the Cain story is you have an obligation to be happy. And I'll tell you, I mean, I remember one time when I was whiny and miserable. I must have been all of 7 years old.
And you're getting into the optimism side, which and the gratitude side. We're going to get to that later.
No. This is just a case of happiness. In other words, we understand, we know, we teach that wealth is the result of how many people you can serve. It's as simple as that. See, life is much too complicated.
Now you're talking. Wealth is the result of how many people
you
can
serve.
So the greater people you can serve or who want to be served leads to greater wealth, right?
Well, clearly. And so, you know, Bill Gates, I'm not talking about morality here. I'm not talking about saintliness. I'm not talking about God's values. I'm saying Bill Gates has served more human beings than Mother Teresa did.
Right.
It's as simple as that. And so he's made a whole lot more money. Now, the number of people you serve is a function of the number of people you know, the number of people who like you, and the number of people who trust you. These are all the things that we absorb with our mother's milk.
Right.
And life is too short to hang out with whiny, miserable, grumpy people who suck all the happiness out of a room.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're taught very early on. And like I said, I once said to my mother, which she was saying, you know, stop whining and stop being miserable. I was 7 years old. And I said, sure, you know, if you buy me a motorcycle, I'll be happy. wow, I got four fingers across my cheek. The mark was there for hours. She said, no, your happiness is not my responsibility. It's yours. And she pulled open towards the end of chapter 24 in Deuteronomy, where there's an obligation, where Jews are told you have to be happy. You don't care what's going on. You've got to be happy. And what that does is, if you absorb that and you learn it, you become a more gregarious person, and other people enjoy being around you, which means you know more people, which means there are more people for you to transact with, do business with, and serve.
So it's working smart, maintaining a positive attitude,
and being filled with a sense of the dignity of service.
And that your own happiness is created by yourself.
Precisely. Because, you know, in your own life and my life, we like hanging out with happy people. It's, you know, you hang out with whiny people who just make you miserable because misery is so contagious.
Mm-hmm. Do Jews encourage specialization in their children?
Yeah, very much so. And again, that's a biblical value.
Mm-hmm.
But, Adam Smith wrote an inquiry into the wealth and causes of the nature and causes of wealth of nations in 1776 is when he published it, and that was sort of when the concept of standardization and specialization was introduced to Western economies. But that is rooted, and of course Adam Smith was a religious Bible believing Scotsman, and the concept is something that Jews knew in the Bible way back in the book of Genesis. And it becomes very, very important. And the reason is because it makes us interdependent. God wants us to be interdependent with each other. He doesn't want people to be able to say to one another, some obscenity, you know, take off, I don't want you in my life. Specialization means that I don't make my own shoes.
Right.
And I really hope that the company that makes the shoes I like wearing stays in business and prospers profitably, because that means I'll be able to always go get a new pair of shoes. And so it is, I want people to pray for my welfare because they need what I provide them with, and vice versa.
And that's getting to be rare in the other communities these days, because a lot of kids who are graduating are being encouraged to generalize. Whereas, you know, the Jewish community, like you say, are encouraged to specialize. So
yes.
Many kids these days, they don't know what to do, so they go do business studies.
That's quite right. Or even worse, people are told to sort of follow your interests.
Mm.
Okay, it sounds very nice and sentimental, but it's not the Jewish way. The Jewish way is follow the avenue
right.
that will allow you to serve as many of God's other children as you possibly can.
What do you see in other communities that prevent them from achieving the same success that the Jewish community has?
Well, it breaks my heart when I speak, as well as having the privilege of being able to speak at many synagogues. I'll be speaking at a synagogue in New York in just a couple of weeks.
Mm.
I also speak at many churches. And it breaks my heart when I come to a church and Vip, honestly, in the first 5 minutes, I can tell that this is a church whose theology, and that's not true for all churches, but this church that I'm visiting, their theology equates poverty with virtue. And there's, you know, there's light bulbs out and the roof needs repair and they could use a coat of paint and the pastor's wife looks stressed from not being able to pay bills. The biggest obstacle, and it's not just some Christians, but it's found everywhere, the biggest obstacle is believing that making money is the same as taking money, that making money is somehow unseemly. And the bottom line is that not one of us, not you or me and none of the people who listen to the show, can truly succeed at any activity that deep in their hearts they consider to be morally reprehensible. And when people deep down believe that money is evidence of bad behavior, that money is created only by people who are greedy and conniving and cunning, they are withheld from exerting their best efforts. So I would say my best answer, my first answer to your question of what is the biggest obstacle, is the belief that somehow or another, making money means you have to sell out spiritually and morally.
Right. And, you know, one thing I do notice is I see a lot of members of the Jewish community, they genuinely go out and help each other climb up the ladder, whatever that ladder may be. And in some other communities, I've seen members of that community pull each other down.
Yes, and I should say, Jews don't just help each other. Look, I've done a lot of research for my books, and I interviewed over 500 non-Jewish, mostly Christian business people who've had lengthy business relationships with Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, you know, we all sometimes tend to see the warts on our own family. And it's all too easy for me as a Jew to sort of see the faults in the Jewish community. This was one of the most heartwarming experiences I had as I traveled the country talking to Christian business professionals, men and women, who'd had lengthy relationships with Jews, how warmly they spoke about them, how warmly they discussed the opportunities that were given to them and the example that was shown to them of widespread generosity and spreading the wealth and doing well. So I really do believe that one of the very important qualities that Jews have is they're open-handed. They don't grab the money and hold on to it. And giving away and sharing with other people is actually, paradoxically, yet another portal to wealth.
And it actually totally goes against the stereotype of which Jews are known for.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very much so. But, you know, people form stereotypes from individuals and then beam them out over the collective. But, you know, are there miserable Jews? Yeah, I think we're probably the same as any other demographic. You know, we have our bad apples, but overwhelmingly, you know, the most valuable business asset is a reputation for integrity, and people wouldn't have, you know, people would by now have learned not to do business with Jews if indeed the experience was a negative one.
But you do see in other communities there's a greater degree of people pulling each other down rather than helping
very
them
much
go
so,
on.
Yes, I know you're absolutely right about that, and enough said.
Now, success is also reflected through wealth. And talking about wealth, you've written a book called Business Secrets from the Bible. And I read it the other day. It's a very compelling book. But it begs the question, what makes you so different from the other, say, get-rich gurus out there?
Well, two things, I think. Number one, I'm not saying that the biblical approach is a get-rich. It's not going to change your financial problems this week. It just isn't. It's not even going to change them this month, but it will change them this year. But what it requires is a comprehensive transformation of how you view money, how you view yourself, how you interact with other people. And so it's not a series of tricks. It's not a series of things to do. It's a series of things to become. And that's always a little harder. It's far from quick. But it is incredibly effective. And the other thing that distinguishes me from many, many other books, and they're, you know, they are wonderful books and things are terrific, but, you know, if you had Donald Trump, if he wasn't otherwise engaged, if you had him here to speak, he'd be much more entertaining than I am, and he's also much more successful financially than I am. However, what he could teach your listeners is restricted to those people whose fathers died and left them $40 million. Now, I'm not saying anybody can convert $40 million to $4 billion. Frankly, I know more entities that have gone the other direction.
Mm.
So I'm not minimizing his accomplishment. I'm just saying it's not relevant to most of us. My teachings are not based on my experience, because my experience is just not terribly exciting. But what my teachings are based on are the experiences of millions of ordinary Jewish people in good times and in bad, in welcoming, hospitable, wonderful countries like the United States, and in brutal, tyrannical regimes and despotic countries as well. In all of these places, not to say they've never been poor Jews, but Jews have been disproportionately successful. And my work was always based on finding out, did this depend on something intrinsic, or was it based on a series of tips and tools and techniques and strategies that could be employed by anybody in their lives, regardless of their religious background or no religious background.
So let me ask you this question. Do you believe that anyone can make money?
Yes, I do. Provided that you are neither dysfunctionally low on the IQ chart like Forrest Gump, who became a tycoon, but I do have to remind everyone that he was a movie.
Right.
And provided you're not too high on the IQ level, in which case you're primarily equipped to serve on a university faculty, and those people are notoriously bad with money. But anyone in the mid-range of normal, broad-range IQ, yes, anybody like that can become successful financially.
Yes, because I think, like you said, you know, part of that philosophy of making money is being able to serve others, right?
Correct.
You said that in the beginning. And obviously you're going to need general IQ in order to know what to serve and what's going to be demanded by those who are going to be served.
And also a certain humility.
Certain humility.
You see, that's part of it. Life is too complicated to run on the basis of simple aphorisms. You know, people say to somebody who's going off to serve in a foreign military deployment for 6 years and he's leaving his sweetheart behind, and everybody says, don't worry, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Mm.
And then just before he gets on the plane, somebody else whispers in his ear, out of sight, out of mind. You know, you find, or somebody says to you, he who hesitates is lost. You know, you've got to grab an opportunity. Mm. And then somebody else says, well, look before you leap. Aphorisms don't work. And that's why I'm very, my book, Business Secrets from the Bible, that you were kind enough to read, isn't, you know, three ways to become rich. You know, it's Business Secrets from the Bible, and I distill it down to 40. And that's a lot.
No, that is a lot. And that's why I think your philosophy is right. It's not a to-do list. It's a become list.
Yeah, right.
And once you become that, you develop the mindset.
Yes. Exactly.
And I'm going to get into that a little later. But, you said anyone can make money. Now, money through business or money through their profession? Because, you know, some are born to be an employee, some are born to be an employer.
Well, I'm sure that you know, as do I, people with law degrees from good universities, from good law schools, who are eking out a living. They're not doing great.
Right.
I'm sure you know accountants and doctors who are not doing great. We also know those who are. What distinguishes them? Those who are not doing great thought that acquiring a diploma, a professional degree from a good school, is a license to make money, that it just all of a sudden and magically happens.
Mm.
It doesn't. The others realize that if you're a doctor or a dentist or a lawyer or an accountant, you are in business. And everything is the same as to whether you are a plumber, or whether you are a bookkeeper, or whether you are a carpet cleaner, it doesn't make any difference. In the final analysis, you still need a mindset of service. You need a mindset of marketing. You need a mindset of let's say, a bedside manner. Does a doctor need a bedside manner any more than a carpet cleaning service does? No, I'd say it's exactly the same. Both have to satisfy their customers that they are the best people to do the job.
So how do families breed those traits within their children? That, you know what, it's just not about doing the job, but in order to be really successful, you have to have a marketing, you know, mindset you have to have.
Well, one of the most challenging things in the Jewish community is that people who grew up in difficult circumstances, their parents were immigrants.
Right.
And people whose parents were immigrants usually don't grow up in the lap of luxury. Work hard, they work smart, they become successful, and they say, I want to give my children all the things that I never had. But the problem is that in so doing, they often neglect to give their children all the things they did have. And in ancient Jewish wisdom, there is a lot of emphasis placed on the fifth commandment of the Ten Commandments, the honoring your father and mother.
Mm-hmm.
And why this is so important is that that is the cradle of service. That is the point at which you learn to give to somebody else. And parents who overdo the lavishness to their children, parents who basically give their children only one responsibility, and that's to drive away in the BMW on their 16th birthday, do not do nearly as well with their children and with their families. And those children don't ultimately do as well as those families following ancient Jewish wisdom precepts. And I've been teaching this for the last couple of years in not only in the Jewish community, but obviously in the Christian community as well. And so people have been practicing these things, but they learn early on that it's not good enough to simply give your children things. You must also demand things from them.
So it's not what you give them, it's what you put in them.
It's what you put in them and what you expect from them as well, not only in terms of academic performance, but in terms of household chores, contributions to the family, earning their allowance. We don't just give an allowance. That's not how the world really works.
How do Jews, how do parents teach Jews, the Jewish children, to have vision? Because, you know, I mean, the great grand success, whether you look at a legal firm, you look at the banks, you look at the entertainment industry, the Jews are right at the top. They control, they're really the puppet masters.
Yes.
How do you teach that?
But wait, before you fall over in envy of Jews, I do want to point out we're heavily underrepresented in the National Football League.
Yes. Thank you for being gracious enough to let the others rise to the occasion.
Exactly. we're not.
But you see, that takes vision. I mean, what you've been talking about in terms of, you know, teaching the kids and things like that, that is like day-to-day discipline and things like that. But where do the kids learn the power of how to hustle?
Well, it's not only of how to hustle, but it's first of all an understanding of how the world really works, and that's crucially important, because if you don't understand how the world really works, then you're going to go to college and you're going to get all excited because of some professor who's going to get you worked up about gender studies or mid-period Etruscan pottery,
right?
Which is nothing but mental masturbation. It's narcissistic. These are things you're interested in. We teach our children, focus not on what you're interested in, because God didn't create you to be a selfish person. He created you to be a giving person.
Right.
Why don't you look around and see what other people need from you? Now, coincidentally or not, that also happens to be the activities that pay a little bit better than comparative art or middle period Etruscan pottery or gender studies. Look and see what other people need of you.
Wow.
And guess what? It makes all the difference.
Yeah, because now you're forced to think and forced to expand your horizon.
Yes, and it's not about you, it's about others.
Right.
And so somebody looks around and says, wow, gee, you know, nobody really seems to be needing a lot of folks with degrees in gender studies, but they do seem to need a lot of folks with understandings of computer programming. So great, that's where I'm going, because that's where they need me. How's this proven? By the dollar value assigned to the activity.
So it's almost like kids are taught how to create entrepreneurial business plans right from scratch.
Look, let me tell you something very important. Mm. And in Hebrew, words, right, the Lord's language, words that mean different things all are related. What I mean to say is that in English, if I say, hey, do you want to play poker? Last night I had a flush. You know, we all know that means, you know, five cards. Okay, fine. Then somebody comes along, little kid comes and says, Daddy, can you come? I went to in the bathroom and I don't know how to flush. And then the carpenter comes and says, I want to put a veneer of plywood flush with the surface of the cabinet. Three uses of flush, none of them have anything to do with any other. But in Hebrew, one word means blood and money. Very important. there are strong similarities. And this is carried through to other cultures as well, which is why we have in English a blood bank and a money bank. And why it is that both in blood and money, we don't have a singular. That comes from the Hebrew origin. You can't say, I need a blood. You say, I need a unit of blood. You can't say, I need a money. I need some money. Blood and money are very similar. In Jewish thinking, we are very comfortable with the idea that money is our lifeblood. It's not something we disparage. It's not something we look at with contempt. Mm. It's not something we pretend to be superior to. We take money very seriously, and that's a good thing, not a bad thing.
So that is a very good thing. I totally agree. So when you say money is the lifeblood, money is what enables you to get things done?
It enables you to feed your family.
Right.
It enables you to fulfill your dreams. It enables you to grow and to live life without the terrible oppression of worries about how you're going to pay your bills. It enables you to fulfill other people. Right? One of the great images that concludes the Sabbath for us is the cup running over. And, you know, my little kids would say to me, so why are you pouring so much wine into the cup for the ceremony of the Havdalah to end the Sabbath? You're wasting it. I'm saying no, because the Sabbath has ended. It's our work week begins. 6 days must you work, seventh you rest. We've had our day of rest. We're now starting the 6 days of work. I won't stop working when the cup is full. I keep on working beyond that as well, because I want there to be something to run over for everybody else as well.
Now, obviously, you're a rabbi and you're going to answer yes to this question, but is it absolutely essential to have a religious belief to make money? And here's why I say this. You know, you have some atheists that are rich.
Of course, no. And even though I'm a rabbi, and the answer is not yes, but no. Of course, you don't need to. For one thing, it's possible for a culture to operate on the fumes in the gas tank. There is so much momentum. Look at an economy the size of the United States of America. It's going to coast on the fumes, even though it's been decades since one can call American culture primarily Judeo-Christian. Mm-hmm. It still retains an enormous amount of vigor. It's a little bit like, if somebody is a very messy person, moves into a lovely neighborhood, and this is a person who litters, and throws everything on the ground, it's going to be many years before he'll find himself living in a slum, because there are a lot of other people still going about things the right way. So yes, I don't think atheism by itself can create an economy, and my evidence for that is it never has. As soon as atheism pushes aside religion, as it did in Cuba, in the Soviet Union, in China, it also suppresses and ultimately destroys the economy. So I don't think atheism per se as a philosophy is helpful for an economy. But can individual atheists be successful? Sure, obviously.
A lot of the get-rich-quick gurus these days and the motivational experts and things like that, they say, you know what, we have to follow our passion, our instinct. That'll lead us to our destiny. And, you know, everyone's imagined destiny is wealth. Is it true, though? Is it something you would recommend?
No, it's unadulterated bilge water.
That's so refreshing. Please expand.
Well, it's complete nonsense. I mean, let me translate that into very direct terms, right?
Please.
I run a small publishing company. I'm looking to hire somebody. And we sit down and have an interview and we talk. And I say to the person, what's your passion? If he answers any one of hundreds of wrong ways, he'll never hear from me again. Because it's a trick question. When I hire somebody, I'm going to have to reach into my pocket to pay him every week or every month because he's not going to be worth anything for me until several months have gone by where his training and his familiarity with my company are enough to enable him to begin to add value. And so it costs me money initially. Do you really think, to be perfectly candid with you, do you really think I care that his passion is to travel throughout the world and backpack in Mongolia? Do I care? Or if he tells me his passion is to one day conduct an orchestra, who cares? I only want to hear one thing, and that is my passion is to add to the bottom line of your company and to make your life easier and more successful by becoming a vital part of your company. That's my passion. And so the world in which the good Lord created us and put us here mm-hmm. is a world in which commitment to others pays off. Selfishness never does. Following your passion is the ultimate expression of narcissistic selfishness. Now, that said, obviously there are people with certain talents, and you'd be foolish to ignore them completely. But the primary driver in where you ought to seek fulfillment in the vast matrix of human economic interaction is where you can deliver most value, not where your passion lies.
That has got to be the best answer ever, Rabbi, because you know what? I've interviewed a lot of motivational people and things like that. And I've always sort of, in my mind, it's always been, you know, how do you explain to a single mother that she has to weigh the potential of her possibilities versus the reality of her responsibilities? You know, you can't drop everything and let your child starve while you're trying to pursue a career of trying to be the next pop star.
Yeah, exactly. And we see it so often today, by the way.
It we seem to be living in a me, myself, and I kind of world.
Right, and also this idea that, you know, it's not going to be hard work that's going to raise me up. I'm going to become a sports star. I'm good at basketball, so you just watch me. So forget school, forget hard work, forget education, because I'm going to be a basketball star. You're going to be poor the rest of your life, kid.
Yeah, because you know what? Everyone constantly picks on two examples like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs.
Yeah, those are outliers.
Yeah, the real world doesn't work like that, you know.
Exactly.
Part of the secret to wealth, reading your book, I wanted to break it down into two parts, the mindset of wealth, and then towards the end of the book, you were talking about the creation of wealth. And the mindset, you know, you said earlier on, was the having that optimistic attitude, the attitude of gratitude as well. And then you felt that was very, very important. Because that attracts people, and you need people to make deals and do business, right?
Yes.
Where did the? I noticed in towards the last part of the book, there was this whole sense of true wealth comes from creation, as opposed to imitation.
Yes. Yes, I think of it in terms of C's: connect, communicate, collaborate, and create.
Tell us a little bit about each.
Well, connect. Something that Gladwell points out in I think it was The Tipping Point, is that the best correlation for wealth is the number of people you can count as friends. And that's exactly right. So, you know, the more people you connect with, the better off you are. Communicate. You know, people often say Jews have the gift of the gab, you know, that we can talk. Look, that doesn't come naturally and easily. That comes about through training, mostly biblical training.
Mm-hmm.
But we have, and I discuss it in the book, we have specific strategies to increase your fluency and your ability to articulate ideas. And these lie at the absolute heart. I mean, I often point out that the most important organ in your body, the most important organ other than the brain, but the most important organ for success in business is the mouth. Your ability to communicate ideas. Hmm. I was once talking to Sir John Templeton a few years, he passed away in 2008, I think it was, but before that, I asked him, Sir John, can you put your finger on what was your most successful investment? Like, you know, what was shockingly successful? He says, yes, airline stocks right after 9/11. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, they plummeted, obviously, because people assumed no one would want to fly on planes again. And he's absolutely right. I'm sure you remember what happened to airline stocks in the years following the terrorist attack. It's not years, I'm sorry, in the months following the terrorist attack. And I said, so what made you dive into airline stocks? He said, because business was always going to be necessary, and for business to take place, people are always going to have to look into one another's faces and look into one another's eyes, sit over a lunch table and make a deal. And for that, people are always going to have to get on a plane. So I knew it would come back. And so that would be connect, communicate, and then collaborate. Collaborate. Learn to work together with people. You try and do everything yourself, and you're becoming, you're saying you want to be a generalist. Do everything yourself means you're going to make the widget, you're going to sell the widget, you're going to do the books of the widget company. What else are you going to do?
Polish the widgets, engage, box them. Engage specialists.
Exactly.
And that's what other communities don't do, because they're always looking at the cheapest way of doing something as opposed to the best way of doing something.
That's right.
Right. So it's connect, communicate, collaborate.
And then we view the opening chapters of Genesis, the whole story of Adam and Eve, as not just a story of the origin of humanity, but it's a metaphor for creativity. You know, it's the most creative thing you can ever do is create a baby, because that baby has the potential beyond all imagining. Mm. And so that metaphor of a man and a woman coming together and performing the ultimate act of creativity is a metaphor for business. And I have an enormous amount of teaching and material that translates that into the practical strategies that people can use to increase their deal-making capacity at every level, starting off as well as advanced success.
So when the Jews go to pray, when they go to the synagogue, do they actually conduct all of this after the prayers are done? It's like a community meeting?
It's not in any sort of formal or organized kind of a way, but the fact is that, as I said, we all like doing transactions with people we know, we like, and we trust. And one of the things you know about, look, let me put it this way, a lot more business is done at churches and synagogues and rotary groups and civic organizations and orchestra board meetings and PTAs than is done at business development groups. Because when you show up at a business development group, you're expressing venality by your being there. You're just saying, this is all about me. I want to get more customers. I want to get more clients. Mm. But when I meet somebody at the PTA or the Boy Scouts group or at church or at synagogue, I'm already talking to a like-minded person who is there for a higher purpose. And now we engage with one another, and yes, I'm more than likely to say to the person after the service, you know, I'm looking for a good dentist. Do you know anybody?
So it's a means to an end scenario.
It's a good, and we don't see anything wrong with that. It's just one of the valuable services that involvement with a synagogue brings.
I love that. I was also watching one of your YouTube clips, and you had a very interesting way of how to increase your own level of communication, then that was reading out a chapter from a good book aloud.
Yes, that's correct. That is one of the very important tools.
Where can we get your books, Rabbi?
Well, my website is youneedarabbi.com. Mm-hmm. And that'd be just a fine place to see excerpts and order the book if you want to, or read more about it. But obviously you can get it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and dozens of other places called Business Secrets from the Bible. And it's made an enormous difference in the financial destiny of literally hundreds of thousands of people now. And I get wonderful letters that I cherish.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I hope you're going to come back.
You need only invite. I can assure you I would be thrilled to be back with you.
Well, in Hebrew, I hope I'm saying it right, Toda Rabba Lecha, my friend.
Absolutely. You, what you said in perfect Hebrew is thank you, thanks to you, and I reciprocate warmly. I appreciate it, and it was wonderful interviewing with you. You really, unlike so many interviews I do, you really know my book, and I appreciate that.
Well, sir, come back soon. Ladies and gentlemen, wise words from one of America's most influential rabbis, and that was Rabbi Daniel Lapin. Thank you all for listening. Your comments and your follow are so very welcome on my Twitter account at VipJaswal and my Facebook page. Just type in VipJaswal Report. A special shout out of thanks to my wonderful team, William Sanchez and Rick Buser. I'll be back next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Until then, I wish you a wonderful evening tonight with your loved ones. And until next Sunday, have a productive and a very happy week ahead.